Finest Studios presents a preview of Proven Leadership Strategies, a novel for navigating storms. Written by Peter Schrock and Harold Gallagher. Narrated by John Reeder. Copyright 2025. All rights reserved. No portion of this audiobook preview may be copied, distributed, or reproduced without prior written consent from the publisher. Chapter 1. The Weight of the World. The object on his desk was a small wooden chess piece, carved from a single piece of pale-colored dense wood. It was a pawn, no bigger than his thumb, with a perfectly rounded head on a solid tiered base. It hadn't been there when he'd collapsed into his chair after the morning's disastrous all-hands meeting. He was sure of it. Mark Trenton picked it up. It felt impossibly heavy for its size, smooth and cool against his skin, a solid, tangible thing in a world that felt like it was dissolving into smoke. He had no idea who could have left it. His office door was always open, an invitation for interruptions he could no longer afford. The hum of the servers from the back room was the only sound that answered his unspoken question. It was the sound of money burning. "This isn't a discussion, people. It's a post-mortem," his boss, Richard, had thundered earlier, his face the color of a ripe plum. The leadership team had gathered in the main conference room, the air thick with the smell of stale coffee and fear. "Project Chimera is sinking, and it's taking this company down with it. I want answers, not excuses. Answers." Mark had felt a dozen pairs of eyes slide toward him. As operations manager, Chimera was his baby. A monstrous, malformed, and very, very sick baby. "The core issue seems to be a cascade failure in the supply chain," Mark had started, his voice sounding thin even to his own ears. "Seems to be?" David, the head of marketing, had pounced on the words, his smile a predatory slash. "Seems to be, Mark. We're 6 weeks past our launch date, bleeding market share to a competitor that didn't even exist a year ago, and we're still operating on what it seems to be?" David was a master of the vague accusation, the kind of corporate assassin who could kill you with a well-placed question mark. He spoke of brand synergy and market penetration, but Mark had never once seen him produce a spreadsheet that contained a real number. It was all feeling, all gut, all expensive, flashy nonsense. "What's your proposal, David?" Richard had asked, turning up the heat. "We need to be aggressive, a full-spectrum marketing blitz. Recontextualize the narrative. We're not late, we're perfecting. We're not failing. We're innovating." Mark had wanted to scream. Innovating what? A new form of bankruptcy? But he'd held his tongue. The problem wasn't the narrative. It was the product. And the product was failing because the parts were failing. But he didn't have the data to prove it. Not yet. He just had the worry. A cold, heavy knot in his stomach that had been his constant companion for months. It was a corrosive feeling. A worry that didn't lead to solutions, only to sleepless nights and a paralyzing sense of dread. Now, hours later, the office was a ghost town, 7:17 p.m. The glow of his monitor painted a map of failure across his face. The sales dashboard was a waterfall of red arrows. He clicked it away, revealing the spreadsheet beneath, a meaningless jumble of figures that blurred into an indictment of his leadership. His phone buzzed on the desk. A sharp, angry sound in the silence. A text from his wife, Jen. "Colton's team won. He scored a goal. He kept looking for you in the stands." The words hit him like a physical blow, knocking the wind out of him. He squeezed his eyes shut, the image of his son's hopeful face turning to disappointment, searing itself into his mind. He saw the drawing Colton had left on his pillow that morning, a stick figure family, all holding hands except for one figure, noticeably detached, holding a briefcase. The weight of it all, the failing project, the condescending peer, the disappointed son, pressed down on him. He felt like a man trying to build a fortress on quicksand. He was losing at work. He was losing at home. He opened his eyes, and his gaze fell on the small wooden pawn still clutched in his hand. It was a stark contrast to the digital chaos on his screen and the emotional chaos in his heart. It was simple, solid, real. Where had it come from? He turned it over and over, his thumb tracing the smooth lines of its base. As he set it down, he noticed a tiny folded piece of paper tucked beneath where it had been. He unfolded it. On it were a few words written in a precise, elegant script. Oak Park. Pond, 8 p.m. The silent, enigmatic object now had an instruction. It felt like a question, a mystery dropped into the middle of his collapsing world. For the first time all day, a feeling other than anxiety flickered within him, a spark of pure, undiluted curiosity. He had no way of knowing it then, but the answer to who had left the pawn was far less important than the journey it was about to begin. Chapter 2. A Man Without. A Principle. Mark slipped the wooden pawn and the mysterious note into his coat pocket. Their combined presence was a tangible weight against his hip on his way out of the quiet office building. As he passed the main corridor, he saw the janitor, Jack, methodically buffing the already gleaming floors. Jack was a fixture in the building, a man who seemed to exist at all hours, always working, always quiet. He was older, with a weathered face and hands that looked surprisingly strong. He always wore a gray hat that matched his gray uniform. On a whim, Mark stopped. "Jack, did you see anyone come by my office in the last few hours?" Jack paused the buffer, the hum dying down. He looked at Mark with calm, steady eyes that seemed to see more than they let on. "Can't say I have, Mr. Trenton. People come and go." Mark hesitated, then pulled the pawn and the note from his pocket. "Someone left me these. It's strange." Jack glanced at the items in Mark's hand, his expression unreadable. He didn't seem surprised or even particularly curious. He just nodded slowly. A man finds something unexpected on his desk, gets a strange invitation. If it were me, I'd want to know what it meant. He said nothing more, just restarted the buffer, its hum filling the empty hallway once more. Mark stood there for a moment, the janitor's simple non-committal words echoing in his mind. He walked into the cool indifference of the night. He got into his car, glancing at the clock. 7:45 p.m. He could be home in 15 minutes, facing the quiet disappointment he knew was waiting, or he could follow this bizarre anonymous summons. Against all logic, the spark of curiosity now fanned by Jack's cryptic encouragement won out over the dread. Instead of turning toward home, he turned the other way, his mind racing with questions. Who would leave him a chess piece? Who would summon him to a park so late in the evening? It felt absurd, like a scene from a spy movie, but it was also the only thing in his collapsing world that felt like it might lead somewhere new. He drove with a strange sense of purpose, following the familiar route to the old forgotten patch of green he hadn't visited in years. He killed the engine, and the sudden silence was deafening. A couple of benches sat under a sprawling oak tree, overlooking a still pond shrouded in a light mist. He walked over and sat down, the quiet, a stark contrast to the alarms in his head. He just breathed, watching the ripples on the water as a duck drifted lazily by. For a moment, the crushing weight on his chest seemed to lift, diffused into the misty air. A soft, rhythmic scraping sound broke the stillness. On the adjacent bench sat an older man, perhaps in his late 70s. "Where did he come from?" Mark thought. He was whittling a small piece of wood with a well-worn pocket knife, his movements patient and precise. He had a kind face, etched with lines that spoke of both joy and sorrow. A pair of thick black plastic frame glasses sat on his nose. His eyes, focused on his work, seemed to hold a peculiar, knowing twinkle even in the dim light. Mark watched him, mesmerized by the steady, purposeful motion of his hands. The man seemed utterly at peace, a small island of calm in Mark's turbulent sea. They sat in a comfortable silence for several minutes, the only sounds being the scraping of the knife and the distant murmur of the city. Then the old man spoke, his voice gentle but clear, without looking up from his carving. "Being concerned about something is okay," he said, as if continuing a conversation they'd been having for hours. "Being worried about it is not." Mark froze. The words, so simple and unexpected, landed like a ton of bricks. They were the perfect articulation of the corrosive feeling that had been eating him alive. He looked at the stranger, startled. How could he have known? The old man finally paused his work, brushing a few stray wood shavings from his trousers. He looked up, and his eyes, clear and direct, met Mark's. There was no pity in them, only a calm, steady understanding. "Worry is a rocking chair," the man continued, his voice raspy with age but firm with conviction. "Gives you something to do, but it doesn't get you anywhere. Concern, now. Concern is different. Concern implies you're getting ready to do something about it. It's the first step toward a solution." He picked up a fresh piece of wood, turning it over in his calloused hands. "And before you can even begin to find a solution, you have to listen. Really listen. The person doing the job knows more about it than anyone. They know where the real problems are, and often they know the solution too. You just have to give them the chance to tell you." Mark stared, speechless. It was as if this stranger had reached into his chest, pulled out the tangled knot of his anxiety, and laid it bare for him to see. Was this man spying on him? Who is this guy? But the words caught in his throat. The old man offered a small, knowing smile. "Name's Silas," he said, extending a hand. "Silas Sinclair." Mark hesitated for a second before taking it. The man's grip was surprisingly firm. "Mark? Mark Trenton." "Well, Mark Trenton," Silas said, his gaze returning to the pond, "looks like you've got a choice to make. Are you going to keep rocking in that chair, or are you going to stand up and walk?" The question hung in the cool night air, simple, direct, and utterly profound. It was a challenge, but it felt like an invitation. An invitation to a path Mark hadn't realized existed until this very moment. Chapter 3. The Untuned Machine. The words followed Mark into the office the next morning. "Stand up and walk." He'd slept poorly, but for the first time in months it wasn't the sleep of a man drowning in a sea of worry. It was the restless sleep of a man contemplating a difficult journey. Silas's distinction between worry and concern had replayed in his mind. Worry was passive, a victim's emotion. Concern was active, the posture of a leader. On his calendar for 10 a.m. was a meeting with Sarah Jenkins, the lead engineer on Chimera's primary processing unit. The meeting's purpose, as far as his boss Richard was concerned, was for Mark to light a fire under her. The data showed her team's output was slow and riddled with errors. Mark had been ready to march into that meeting armed with charts and a stern lecture. But today, he was concerned and a little more open to listening. On his way in, Mark had stopped at the Daily Grind, a local coffee shop with a warm, inviting atmosphere. He'd bought two coffees in a cardboard carrier and walked into the office, the rich aroma cutting through the stale, recycled air. He balanced them carefully as he walked to Sarah's cubicle. She looked up as he approached, her expression already defensive, as if bracing for impact. "Morning, Sarah," he said, offering the carrier. "Got a minute? I was hoping we could talk. That little huddle room is free." The surprise on her face was evident. She took one of the cups, her fingers brushing the warm cardboard. Sure, thanks." Mark liked to meet places other than his office because if he needed to leave or end a meeting, it gave him a place to retreat. The huddle room was a small glass box, offering privacy, but not secrecy. Anyone walking by could see them talking. They sat down, the coffee cups forming a small barrier between them. He didn't start with the metrics. He didn't start with the delays. He decided for once to just listen. "Tell me how it's really going, Sarah," he said simply. She gave him a wary look, as if expecting a trap. "It's challenging. We're working through the issues." "I'm not here to blame anyone," Mark said, leaning forward. "I'm here to understand. Help me see what you're seeing." As he looked at her, at the dark circles under her eyes, the tension in her jaw, the way her fingers nervously tapped her coffee cup, he could see the evidence that something was wrong. He had only seen charts and data points. She was living the problem. He was in meetings, shuffling papers and promises. She was on the front lines, fighting a battle he couldn't even perceive. At that moment, Silas's words hung in his mind. "No one knows the job better than the person doing it." It was a simple idea, but it changed everything. It shifted him from judge to student. The shift in his own perspective, the silent acknowledgement of her expertise, must have shown on his face. Her shoulders slumped, not in defeat, but in a weary release of tension. She took a deep breath. Mark, we have multiple problems, but it's not the designs. It's not my team, she said, her voice low and urgent. The tools we have in the shop aren't accurate enough, and they keep breaking down. We tried to save money by getting cheaper brands, but now it's costing us time. Mark looked at her with some compassion and said, Yes, let's not try to save money on tools. We need them to get the job done. However, things like nuts and bolts or parts based on a spec, we should be able to save money on these. Sarah slumped in her chair. Well, that's the other problem. Our parts are not up to spec. They're garbage. She pulled her phone from her pocket and slid it across the table. It showed a series of emails and photos. This is from Vextech, our supplier. We're supposed to be getting microcontrollers rated for 1.2 gigahertz. The last three shipments, most of them can't even sustain 1.0 without overheating. They're either factory seconds or outright counterfeits. We spend half our time just testing and rejecting parts. We're not building. We're just doing quality control for a supplier that doesn't care. She scrolled to another email. I've flagged this to Vextech three times. This was their last response. Mark read the curt, dismissive reply, which essentially told Sarah to reread the technical specifications and stop wasting their time. Why didn't you bring this to me? Mark asked, a cold dread creeping up his spine. Sarah looked away, staring into her coffee. Honestly? Because everyone is looking for a scapegoat. I figured if I pointed the finger at a supplier, it would just look like I was making excuses for my team's performance. I thought I could, I don't know, work around it. Mark felt a flush of shame. She was right. He had been so focused on the internal metrics, on Richard's pressure, on David's snide remarks that he'd forgotten to look at the whole picture. He'd been trying to tune an engine without checking if it had any fuel. He now understood the real problem, the source of the rot. But this knowledge wasn't a relief. It was a new, more terrifying weight. Vextech wasn't just any supplier. They were Richard's pet vendor, a company he'd brought in himself, constantly praising their aggressive pricing and can-do attitude. To challenge Vextech was to challenge Richard's judgment. It was to walk directly into a political minefield. He had stood up from the rocking chair, just as Silas had challenged him to do. But as he looked at Sarah's exhausted but hopeful face, he realized his first step forward had landed him on the edge of a cliff. Chapter 4. The Power of a Question. The Vextech problem burned in Mark's mind like a hot coal. It was the kind of problem that could end a career, a political grenade with the pin already pulled. But before he could even begin to think about how to defuse it, he was summoned to another fire. Conference room, 10 minutes, Richard's email barked. Urgent, competitive strategy session. Mark walked into the room to a scene of barely controlled panic. The new competitor, a nimble startup named Apex Solutions, had just announced a new feature that directly targeted Innovate Dynamics' core client base. The news had sent shockwaves through the leadership team. They're eating our lunch, Richard said, pacing in front of the whiteboard. They're faster, they're cheaper, and now they're out-innovating us. What are we going to do? David, the head of marketing, stepped forward, practically vibrating with self-importance. He tapped a marker on the board. It's a perception war, Richard. We need to hit back, and hit back hard. I'm proposing a multi-platform campaign. We'll saturate the market. We'll offer a 20% discount to any Apex client who switches to us. We'll fight fire with fire. The room murmured in agreement. It was a plan, an aggressive, tangible plan. It felt like action, but to Mark, it felt like desperation. He thought of Sarah, of the faulty components, of the product they couldn't even build properly. Discounting a broken product was like putting a sail sign on a sinking ship. A few days ago, Mark would have stayed silent, overwhelmed by the consensus. But the conversation with Silas echoed in his mind, followed by the raw truth from Sarah. He was seeing a room full of executives about to spend millions of dollars based on fear and guesswork. Hold on, Mark said. The room fell silent, surprised by his interruption. He walked to the whiteboard. David, you say they're cheaper. How much cheaper? David blinked. Well, significantly, they're undercutting us across the board. A thought crystallized in Mark's mind. The trouble with people who don't know what they're talking about is that they don't know when to stop. Mark pressed his advantage. How much is significantly? By 5%, 10%, 25%? What's the actual number? David stammered. I'd have to get the exact figures from my team. And you say they're faster, Mark continued, turning to the head of sales. What's their average deployment time compared to ours? Do we have data on that? And what about their customer support? What's their average ticket resolution time? The room was filled with blank stares. They had feelings. They had fears. They had no numbers. A new clarity washed over Mark. It was another epiphany, a piece of wisdom clicking into place with the satisfying certainty of a well-machined part. If you can't describe something using numbers, you don't know what you were talking about. They were all just talking. We're trying to solve a problem we haven't even defined, Mark said, his voice gaining confidence. He looked at Richard. Before we spend a dime on a marketing war, we need to ask the right questions. The problem isn't Apex is beating us. That's a conclusion. The problem is a set of facts we don't have yet. He uncapped a blue marker. The first question is, where specifically are we losing and by how much? The second is, where are they genuinely better and where are they just perceived as better? And the third and most important question is, where are they weak? He felt a profound shift in his own thinking. He wasn't just repeating something he'd been told. He was understanding it from the inside out. The answer to every problem lies in a properly crafted question. Richard had stopped pacing. He stared at the whiteboard, at the simple, direct questions Mark had written. It was as if Mark had cut through a fog of panic with a sharp knife. Get the numbers, Richard said, his voice low but firm. He wasn't looking at David anymore. He was looking at Mark. I want a full analysis. Dig into their customer reviews, their support forms, everything. Find their weakness. He paused. David, hold off on the campaign blitz. Mark, I want this on my desk in 48 hours. Mark nodded, a feeling of quiet triumph mixing with a new wave of pressure. He had won the battle, but in doing so, he'd publicly sidelined David and taken on a massive new responsibility. And all the while, the unexploded bomb of the Vex-Tech situation was still ticking in his pocket. He had just volunteered to fight a war on two fronts. Chapter 5. The Hasty Rush. The glow from the victory in the strategy session was short-lived, a brief ceasefire in a war now being fought on two fronts. The 48-hour deadline for the Apex analysis was a ticking clock in one ear, while the Vex-Tech problem was the low-grade fever of an untreated wound. He slumped into his chair, the weight of it all pressing down, and his eyes fell upon his desk. He had placed the two pawns there earlier. One was the original pale-colored piece that he had found the other night. Next to it was the new dark one Silas had carved for him during their first talk. He had set them facing each other, two lone soldiers on a battlefield, poised and waiting for the command to engage. He stared at the two small figures, grappling with the symbolism. Why pawns? Why not a more powerful piece? He couldn't shake the feeling that Silas was implying something profound about his situation. Was he just a pawn in a much larger game? Perhaps he was reminding him that even the smallest pieces have a critical role to play. The thought didn't just stir anxiety, it coiled in his stomach like a cold snake, a feeling that he was missing a crucial part of the puzzle. An email notification flashed on his screen, breaking the spell. The subject line was from Richard. Forward, urgent, Vex-Tech limited time offer. Mark's heart sank as he read it. It was a formal proposal from Vex-Tech, offering a massive 20% discount on a bulk order of their microcontrollers, the very components Sarah had proven were faulty. Richard's message was blunt. Mark, this is a huge opportunity. The cost savings on this bulk order would put the Chimera project significantly under budget. Vex-Tech says the offer is only good until the end of the day. Let's not be penny-wise here. I need your sign-off by 4 p.m. so we can lock this in. This is a big win for us. It was a trap. A beautiful, gold-plated, budget-saving trap. Richard, blinded by the dollar signs, was pressuring him to make a hasty choice, to commit to a year's worth of components that could be utterly worthless. The weight of it all, the dueling deadlines, the mysterious pawns, the pressure from his boss, felt crushing. He needed advice. He needed clarity. He needed the calm, steady wisdom of the old man in the park. Driven by a desperation that overrode all logic, Mark grabbed his keys and left the office. The park was quiet, the afternoon sun filtering through the leaves. He saw him immediately. He was just now sitting down on the bench where he was before, opening his bag to whittle a small piece of wood. A wave of relief washed over Mark. "Silas," Mark began, sinking onto the adjacent bench without introduction. He barely knew the man, but he laid out the whole impossible situation, the pressure from Richard, the bad components, the end-of-day deadline. "He wants an answer now. If I say yes, I could be poisoning the entire project. If I say no, I'm turning down a massive cost saving, and Richard will see it as me being difficult and indecisive." Silas didn't look up from his carving. "Sounds like they're trying to rush you." "They are," Mark said. "I feel like I'm trapped." "Then the answer is simple," Silas said, his knife making a soft scraping sound. "When you're being pressured to make a quick choice, the answer is always no." Mark stared at him. "Just no? That's it?" "That's it," Silas confirmed. He finally paused his work and looked at Mark, his eyes clear and direct. "Saying no isn't a rejection of the deal, Mark. It's a rejection of their timeline. It's a tool that reclaims your control. The person rushing you is doing it for their benefit, not yours. They're creating a false sense of urgency, hoping you'll make a mistake. When you say no, you stop their game. You force them to play on your timeline, which gives you the one thing you need most, time to solve your problems." The wisdom of it was so simple, so profound, that Mark felt a knot of tension in his chest loosen. It wasn't about fighting Richard. It was about solving their problems without creating more. Mark turned toward Silas with a pleading look in his eyes. "Silas, are you here often? I feel like I could use your advice more than I'd like to admit." Silas put his hand on a wadded-up gray hat next to him and gave a mysterious smile. "I'm here as much as I need to be." "But what if I need you and you're not here?" Mark pressed, a new anxiety surfacing. "Could we, I don't know, set up regular time to meet? Maybe we could meet weekly?" Silas chuckled, a warm, dry sound. "Just meet me here, Mark." "But I don't want to drive all this way just to sit and stare at the ducks by myself," Mark protested politely. "Perhaps," Silas said, his eyes twinkling, "staring at the ducks by yourself is exactly what you'll need on that day." He saw the look on Mark's face, and his expression softened. "Don't you worry. If you really need me, I'll be here." Mark felt a sense of doubt. How could he know when he would be needed? Mark stood up, a little frustrated by Silas's odd commitment. Was Silas homeless? He needed to get back to work. As he turned to leave, Silas held out his hand. In his palm was another freshly carved pawn. Mark hesitated. "Why do you keep giving me these pawns?" he asked, his voice full of confusion. Silas just smiled, a knowing look in his eyes. "All the pieces will come together in the end, Mark. You'll see." Mark took the small wooden pawn, its familiar weight a comfort in his hand. The words were cryptic, but strangely reassuring. He now had a reason to push back on the Vextech deal and focus on the real threat. Apex. The first step was to say no. The second step was to build a team and figure out what made their competitor tick. He headed back to the office, not with a solution, but with a strategy, ready to face this storm. Thank you for listening to the preview of Proven Leadership Strategies, a novel for navigating storms. This book will be available to purchase from Amazon.com after its release on October 10th, 2025. When you purchase the printed or Kindle version of this book, you will receive a complimentary copy of this full audiobook. Order your copy today.